Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is CEO of Atrium Music and television supervising editor Josh Young. Let's start here, though. After Universal Music pulled its catalog from TikTok due to the microscopic royalties it was receiving just a few months ago, no one was sure what was going to happen. Would Universal Music take a revenue hit? Would TikTok viewership take a dive? It looks like neither has happened. It turns out that UMG's market share is in exactly the same place that it was before the ban. There's been no change in their artist streaming numbers. In other words, it hasn't made a difference at all. What this proves is that TikTok is not as influential as once thought. Even though the royalties it pays to artists and songwriters are almost non-existent, the idea is that if a user was exposed to a song on the platform, he or she would then seek it out on a dedicated music streaming service like Spotify. The streaming numbers haven't budged since the TikTok ban, though, which proves that that isn't true. What's more, the other major labels are now considering pulling their catalogs from TikTok as well. TikTok numbers also haven't changed much either, although many creators are really upset that the music on their videos disappeared on February 1st. That said, the platform tried an experiment in Australia where it used zero music from the major labels, and they found that their active user numbers did go down. Another way to look at this is that Universal and the other major record labels are looking at what might happen if Congress passes the law banning TikTok in the United States. It's better to prepare for that now than have to worry about the consequences later. Whichever way you look at it, Universal Music pulling its catalog from TikTok has not worked out the way anyone thought it would so far. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. There's new research that the lyrics of popular songs have been dumbed down over time. In fact, researchers say that English language lyrics are now much simpler and more repetitive than they were in 1980. The findings were published in the Scientific Reports Journal and looked at the lyrics from 12,000 rap, country, pop, R&B, and rock songs released between 1980 and 2020. They looked at 2,400 songs from each of the five genres. The report found that the lyrics are indeed simpler, but are definitely easier to understand. The team also found that the number of different words used within songs has decreased, particularly in rap and rock songs. But they also discovered that the number of words with three or more syllables has increased in rap tracks since 1980. They also found that lyrics have tended to become more emotional and personal over time, while the use of emotionally negative lyrics increased in rap, pop, and country songs, and all genres showed an increase in the use of anger-related words. One thing that's interesting is that lyrics of older rock songs tend to be viewed more online than those of newer ones, while lyrics of new country songs tend to be viewed more than those of older ones. There's been a lot of speculation on why the changes in lyrics happened, but the researchers speculate that the trend reflects changes in music consumption, such as increases in songs being played as background music. Personally, I think it's the fact that songs are so much shorter today, so the lyrics have to be to the point and be provocative to keep people listening. Have you noticed this change? Let me know what you think. My guest this week is Josh Young, who's the founder and CEO of Atrium Music, as well as an Emmy-nominated supervisor, television, and film editor. His credits include shows like Lego Masters, Big Brother, World of Dance, The Masked Singer, and many more. Atrium Music is a publishing and music library that licenses and places music in television, film, and commercial productions. The company allows artists to be artists while allowing the business structure of Atrium to handle their business needs. When not producing, editing, and music supervising television shows, Josh speaks at conferences and educational institutions across the United States and is a board member of the California Copyright Conference. During our interview, we spoke about why communication skills are so important, the duties of a supervising television editor, the hectic pace of a hit TV show, learning a new workstation software package, what makes Atrium Music different from other libraries, and so much more. I spoke with Josh from a studio outside of Los Angeles. Talk about your background and you getting into the business that you're in. Go back to the beginning, though. Take me to the beginning.
Well, my original background was in music. I played music since I was 5 years old, saxophone, piano. Went to a music academy for the arts, did shows, musicals, all sorts of stuff. Went to college for music, thought I was going to be a studio musician. I ended up touring, playing on several albums and things like that. And in my third year of college, after speaking to quite a few of my mentors, realizing they're all doing something else to make a living. And it was kind of mind blowing. I was like, wait, I can't make a living being a musician. And so at that time, I was diving into a lot of different aspects. I was on the stage crew doing, you know, learning lighting and all that kind of stuff, and doing recording arts and learning that kind of stuff, and kind of figured out that one of the things I really loved was video editing. So I ended up diving into video editing, found an internship in the for post-production for a TV show, and just kind of learned the production world the hard way. And I was going to go to school for it, but I just ended up working, and I just worked my tail off. And eventually I became a supervising editor. I started working editing at nights and just kind of proving myself. And along that journey, I also had a recording studio with a business partner of mine in Pasadena. And so during the day, I would go edit on shows. And at night, I'd go to the studio and I'd edit more all night. And he was in the other room recording artists. And we'd have an amazing fire pit outside and just hanging out. And it was just kind of like enjoying life quite a bit. And it was a lot of fun. And realizing that also with the recording industry, you're limited on how many clients you can have in a particular studio and how often you can have them there. So you're really capped at your potential of what you can do. And meanwhile, I was editing all these shows, and all these libraries that we were using were really not really great in this world where all these artists wanted record deals because of they could get licensing and they could be on TV shows was really kind of unknown at that time. But there was also this big fear of being taken advantage of. My publishing is going to get stolen. My masters are going to get stolen. Somebody's going to lie to me. Like, because there's just so much of that in this music business. And so we kind of decided, like, hey, why don't we create a model that's fair and transparent to artists, right? Like, we have all these amazing artists coming through the studio. Let's do something with it. And it was a great idea because it allowed us to have the end result making money for everybody and not having to build this label model where we had to come with a whole bunch of money and not know what the results are going to be, right? So the harder we work, the more results we're going to get. The harder and the better the artist is, the more results they're going to get. And it was kind of like we are all a team working for the same goal, and we are all taking the same amount of risks in different facets. So that's basically how we created Atrium. And so that's what we focus on now. We're artist-driven music sync agency that focuses on placements in TV shows, films, commercials, and we also operate worldwide for royalty collection.
Are you still doing video editing?
Oh yeah, I love it. I have an amazing team at Atrium, so it allows me to still edit. So I get to edit all the different shows that are going on. Next week, I'm doing a whole thing at South by Southwest for Spin Magazine, which is really kind of exciting. We're doing live editing on the spot with all the music artists that coming through and doing interviews and things like that. So I still get to play with all the toys and be invested in this music world, which I just absolutely love.
Okay, I want to get to Atrium in a second. But first of all, just tell me, what does a pro editor know that someone who may be good at editing doesn't, but doesn't have the same amount of experience?
Relationships. How to deal with people, how to deal with personalities, how to manage expectations, I think is a really big one that I've learned. I think anybody can use and learn the tools. I think how you use those tools are really important. I don't think I'm doing anything amazingly creative. I'm not doing anything groundbreaking, but I've been really receptive to my mentors, the guys who give me notes, the critique, and I just try to take everything in and apply that to my next job, you know, and I really try to build on my experience. And so that way, when I have another client, be it a small individual, you know, pilot or documentary, all the way to a huge network TV show, I can apply all those things that I've learned in those situations and hopefully make it a better, you know, user experience, so to speak, with my producers, my supervisors, which a lot of times they may not know more than me, right? Like I'm taking orders from people who really don't have the experience. And so how do you communicate with them where one, you're not threatening their job, but you just want to create the best product possible, right? Those are all kind of like communication, people management skills that I think is kind of a lost art. I think probably with any industry, and especially the entertainment industry, where we're all freelance, people are getting promoted to leadership and supervisor positions, but they're not trained in leadership, right? And so that ends up kind of being breaking down, where these people are telling you what to do and how to do it, but they don't really know how to manage people. And so you're not getting the best out of your crew that you know, really, really could. So I love leadership. So that was another thing that's been really fun that I get to experience and kind of research a little bit. But yeah, I don't know, just the experience and relationships, I think, are the most important part of this.
I should know this since I live so close to the industry, basically in the industry.
Yeah.
But does a supervising editor do much editing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've done shows like Lego Masters. I did Masked Singer. I've worked on Bachelor. I've done Temptation Island. Like I've done all these big shows. And I think more than anything, a lot of the times, if budget allows, I get in there a couple of weeks early. I get to help set up the process. I get to know the editors that are coming on, who are about to come on, and we get to create this infrastructure that is hopefully a solid foundation that can move as fast as possible. Because a lot of times these shows, we're going to have 20 editors. You know, we may have another 15 story producers and 5 assistant editors, and we're all going at the same time. And so on some shows, depending on who the executive producer is and what role they want me to have, yes, I'm absolutely editing. I have more expectation to edit more, but I'm also managing the workflow and the process and, you know, explaining to the other editors how we're going to do things. So it's definitely a bigger role, but I kind of thrive in those situations.
See, that's what I like about television, though. It's so run and gun. It's like, we got to get it done. So let's go. Yeah. And whenever I've had to do some filming and I hired a crew, there was a distinct dichotomy between film people and TV people. TV people is like, okay, we're done. Let's go. And film people, oh, wait a second. No, just stop. Let me change this light over here. Yeah. And they'd be so artsy about it that, you know, say, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Time.
No, it's definitely run and gun. I even worked on a show called Big Brother for 10 years. And you want to talk about run and gun, like that show is almost live. We were doing 3 shows a week. It's still on, but I stopped doing it. But we were doing 3 shows a week. And what was happening live in the house on like Sunday would air Tuesday. What was happening live on Tuesday would air Thursday. And what was happening Thursday would air and Friday would air Saturday. And we were doing that all summer long. We would do 40 episodes a summer. And I would work 3 24-hour shifts a week. So I would come in and I was the finishing editor. And so I would mix online and color an episode in one shift. So I was there for, you know, 20 to 24 hours in the beginning and of the season. Towards the end, it would get maybe down to 15 to 20 hours, depending on what it was. But that was interesting because it was such a fast turnaround. Everybody had a role, right? But then there was also a huge aspect of building a team around me and my superiors that I could learn to delegate and I can manage my time. Like, this needs to be done at this time, no matter what. Great. I need you to do this. I need you to do this. Do this for me, please. This is how we're going to set it up ahead of time. And so that way, when those things end up coming, I knew exactly where things were going to be. They knew where exactly things were going to be. And we could kind of build it out as a team. And man, those were a lot of fun days. Long nights, but fun days.
What workstation do you use? What editor, out of curiosity?
I've been using Media Composer Avid for 24 years now. I've branched out. And I'm now using DaVinci Resolve, which I really like. And I'm kind of at the point where I'm trying to learn as much as I can. Like, I don't want to become an old dinosaur. Like, I'm stuck in my ways. I want to learn everything. So that way, when I get a job that starts in Abbott and finishes in Resolve, I can do both of it, or I can speak both languages. You know, like, I had a recording studio, so I can talk in post-production. I understand Pro Tools. I understand the workflow from, you know, pre-production all the way to delivering a show. And so when somebody's has a question about something, we can say, oh, well, let's do it this way, because I know in the end they're going to want this. Right. And so just learning everything right now, I think, is kind of that season that I've been in.
It's funny, because once you get stuck in a program, it's hard to break out sometimes. I've used Final Cut for a long time, and I wanted to go to DaVinci, and it just took me a while to get my arms around. It wasn't as fast as I thought it was going to be, or fast for me to get my arms around it.
That was the big learning curve. I was like, I know how to operate this system like nobody else, you know? Yeah. And then you get into a new platform, you're like, you feel like you're learning all over again. And it's frustrating, because it's almost like an attack on your ego, yeah. Right? You're like, I can do this faster. You're like, that's all right. But I learned on, I mean, my first editing platform was iMovie. And then I did, you know, and then I did Final Cut. I've done Premiere, but the industry was basically Avid. So I've done that. And now a lot of the Avid shows or big shows are finishing and coloring in DaVinci Resolve. And so now I'm learning, you know, and I would say I've learned it at this point, you know, because I'm actually using it professionally. But there was a learning curve for a couple of months. And I was doing any and all little projects I could in order to retrain my tools. Like, I knew creatively what I wanted, which was a huge hurdle. It's like learning to play an instrument. You know how to read music. Now you're just learning to play the other instrument.
Yeah.
Right. So like there's that part of it, I feel like, is I just had to keep reminding myself about.
Let's go to Atrium Music. So you saw an opportunity and you decided to jump into it, but it's difficult. And I say this only because I know people have tried to do it and have failed. It's difficult to get music, to get people to trust you at what you're doing. So how did that happen for you?
I feel it was our business model. You know, a lot of deals, they want to take your publishing, or you get a publishing deal and you're working for somebody and they take your publishing and it's a work for hire. And so there ends up being this world where trust is really important. And so the way that we created it is we're working with the artist. So they can see everything that we do. And there's never a question about when the money comes in, who's getting it, right? Like, it's every deal that we have with every artist is the same. We're not negotiating. And we've done that several times. We do that intentionally because we wanted the singer-songwriter in a coffee shop to say, have the same opportunity as the big New York attorney representing an artist coming in and negotiating. And there's been those times where they come in and be like, nope, we don't want to do 50%. We want 70%. And then our response to them is like, you know what? I hear you. We're probably just not the right fit for you, but good luck. You know, like in all sincerity, we're not right for everybody and what their goals are. And then we would hear back a month later, like, hey, what happened with our deal from the artist? And they're like, oh, your attorney wanted more than we could offer. And, you know, we really try to make it a fair deal for everybody. Oh yeah, we like that about you. Okay, we're going to sign. Right. Like, and I think staying really, really consistent, sticking to our beliefs and being honest and having integrity in everything that we do, the biggest tool that people have seen in us is people's word of mouth. Right. Like, and we get that all the time. It's like, I've heard great things about Atrium. I want to work with you guys. Right. Like, I see what you're doing. I've heard what you guys do. I hear how you guys treat artists. We want to be a part of that. Right. And now that's just growing exponentially. And we're so blessed to be able to just have artists come from other artists, you know, and we get to have those conversations, or I'll get texts like, man, I'm so excited about the conversations we just had with Atrium. Like, how do we get more involved? Can you guys be a record label? You know, like, I had that comment. I was like, wow, that's awesome. No, we don't want to be a record label, but I appreciate the compliment where people can see who we are and what we're about, you know, and that's really neat.
How big is your catalog?
We have about 25,000 tracks right now.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. And just over 1,000 artists worldwide.
Is there a typical client that wants your tracks?
Sure. Generally speaking, music supervisors, seek us out because they're representing a show that they're trying to find music for. So it's either existing relationships with, you know, a lot of music supervisors, like, hey, we're jumping on the show, Josh, we're looking for music like this. And they send us their brief and we send them a bunch of music that fits what they're looking for. And they either use it or they don't, or they come back and say, we want more. That's generally our biggest client. Or it'll be producers who may not have a music supervisor. It could be ad agencies looking for a particular piece of music. That's really the majority of our clients.
Will you do custom tracks?
Always, yeah. We do a lot of custom tracks. We'll jump onto a show and we'll license music and then we'll start writing music specifically for the show. Or we will go out and source music that the music supervisor is looking for on behalf of the show, but we add them to the Atrium catalog. So the music supervisor doesn't have to work quite as hard, but they're still getting the quality that they're looking for.
Let's talk about AI for a second, because I think the one place, well, there are several places that AI may be a problem down the road music-wise. One of them is mastering, and the other one is for catalogs, for production music. What's your feeling on that?
I think there's a lot of hurdles for AI. Right now, I think like anything, there's a really good place for it. I don't think there's a great place for AI when it comes to creative stuff, right? Like, you know, you as a painter would create a painting based on your life's experience, right? And it can be however you decide to paint it, how you're feeling in that particular moment, right? And when someone looks at that, they're going to have an emotional reaction. And I feel like AI is a tool to get you to a particular place, but I don't think it can land the plane necessarily, right? Like it's not going to give you, when you listen to a song, or if I sit down, like one of my favorite artists is a John Bellion. Like I can sit down and listen to any of his albums front to back, lay on the floor, turn the music up and just be transported to another place. AI isn't going to do that for me. But I think when it comes to production music, we're seeing things that we haven't seen before. We're seeing AI kick out hundreds of tracks in a day. Right now, it kind of sounds like AI, and it can get you there. And I think there's going to be a world where, look, we have so much media out there. There really is. Like, you know, between TikTok and Instagram and, you know, all the social media platforms, all the cable platforms, people are going to use the AI production music. And I think that's going to be, I think that's great for what it is. I think for what we're doing, we are representing the creative artist. Now, I've heard some amazing programs replicate vocals, like unbelievable. But it's also starting off with somebody who's incredibly experienced, who knows how to get what they want.
Yeah.
Right. And so I still think there's always going to be a human aspect to AI or just intelligent software, right? Like it's not all autonomous. It's, you know, like I can program an Excel spreadsheet to do certain things. It doesn't necessarily make it AI, right? Like you're just creating algorithms. And I think this idea of AI is kind of blown out of proportion to some degree, right? But I'm interested to keep watching it. There are all these copyright lawsuits right now, right? So just like anything, I think things will settle down. There's going to be, you know, some legislation that takes place on AI and copyrights and, you know, that kind of stuff. Luckily, the business that we're in, there's already laws in place when it comes to copyrights, copyright infringements, licensing for media and that kind of stuff. So there's not a lot of gray area in a particular place that we're in. But I'm definitely watching it as close as I can.
Yeah, I wrote a book, AI for Music Production, came out the end of last year.
Nice.
And I did a lot of research, obviously, and I talked to a lot of copyright attorneys on this. What was interesting is if you look at a lot of the AI music platforms, the text-to-music platforms, they're tiered. So a free tier, whatever the quality of the music, doesn't matter. The free tier basically says, oh, you can play with it, but you can't use it anywhere.
Mm.
Oh, by the way, if you pay $9.95 a month, oh, you can use it, but you can only use it on YouTube and Instagram.
Right.
And then if you pay $39 a month, then all of a sudden, oh, you own the copyright. But the question is, does the platform actually have the ability to grant you a copyright since it's 100% AI generated? And we know that you can't have a copyright if it's 100% AI generated. So even the platforms don't have this together yet.
Right. Yeah, 100%. I was on the board of the California Copyright Conference, and I think it was like 4 years ago, we had a discussion on that. It was a whole panel on it. And it was like right in the beginning when everything was just starting to take off. And it's like, what are you using to feed the AI? And are you licensing that information? You know, if you take all the Beatles songs and you put them in a platform, did you just take all the Beatles songs and put them in a platform, or did you get permission to generate that? And I think that's the biggest question, but we're seeing that. Was it the LA Times or one of the big news outlets has a big lawsuit now? So I think once, you know, kind of like I said, like once there ends up being some legislation, it's like, okay, anything created from AI is going to be public domain, or anything, you know, you can't make any money off of it. Like whatever those rules end up being and they're established, then I think we can utilize those better tools. So it's interesting to watch. I mean, back in the day, there was the whole issue with like electric keyboards and electric guitars, right?
Yeah, drum machines, so sure.
Yeah, drum machines. So we're kind of on that path again. But we've also seen lawsuits on copyright infringement where, you know, technically copyright infringement is lyric and melody, yet they've granted, you know, copyright infringement based on popularity of artist. Right. And you're like, well, that's not copyright infringement. I think it was like, you know, and just
the blurred lines,
the Katy Perry, yeah, and, Katy, you know, Perry, and all these, yeah, bigger. Right. And it's like, it's not based on the song anymore. It's based on the popularity of the artist, which isn't copyright infringement. It's, yeah, you know, it's taking advantage of the system to some degree. But I'm not an attorney, and we just do the best we can. But it's interesting to watch. And for now, we don't accept any AI. I want all real authentic music. And I had an artist submit it to us. He's like, oh, this is, you know, here's some music. I'm like, sorry, we're not going to accept this music, but it's AI. I'm like, but it sounds like AI.
Yeah.
Right. So like, we don't quite want that yet. And then there's even issues kind of like what you're talking about, where someone goes and gets a vocal splice, but they have the license to put it on distribution, but they don't have the license to broadcast. And so, I mean, that's something that we're constantly dealing with, where it's like, hey, do you have if you did get a sample, do you have permission to have the whole sample? Right. And do you have permission to license? Like, and so we're constantly making sure our artists, because they're still using tools, you know, to some degree, but we want to know that they have the license to be able to use those loops or splices or whatever.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that's an interesting aspect of all this. So with some songs, especially in hip hop, there may be 20 writers on a song, and mostly it's a cover your ass thing. It's like, okay, if you're in the room, you get credit, so you don't come back at us later. So there's a lot of that. Now, that being said, there's also a lot of people that don't have a publishing company that really don't know the ins and outs of it. So then to get clearance on this stuff, it may be impossible. Do you run into that?
Oh yeah, I agree. I think sometimes hip hop is the more difficult genre for us to clear, because you have one person creating the beats, then the person uses the beat. We've had situations where we have artists who want us to run everything through them. And it's like, well, no, if you're the publisher and there's four writers, we want letters of acknowledgement from all the writers acknowledging you own 100% of the publishing, even though technically we don't necessarily need to, because it's the publisher is a copyright owner. So, but we want to do that. And they're like, no, I don't talk to them anymore, you know? And so we've run into situations like that. The hip hop, yeah, clearing it's difficult. It really is. But again, if we can do it and we provide that to a client, they're super happy because they don't need to do it.
Yeah.
Right. And so now with our artists that we work with, they understand, because part of what we're doing too is we're trying to educate our artists. And so we have kind of three different types of people. We have an artist who submits to us. They're like, they're just an artist, but they're like, hey, someone said I should get in the sync. I'm going to get in the sync. Then you have artists who are artists and writing for sync, right? They're doing both. Or you have people literally just writing for sync. And so in the last two cases, we're really trying to educate more on how to deliver music better, how to manage your music better, how to communicate with your co-writers better, right? And so that way it becomes a more seamless experience, not only for them, but for us. And if they're doing anything not related to Atrium, now they have the ability to negotiate and have things prepared for other music supervisors or whatever catalogs that they're pitching to.
I'm glad you went there because that was my next question. When you get music that you don't feel is sync ready, what is the problem generally?
It could be a number of things. It could be a quality. It could be a lack of producing. It could be a lack of sounds, right? Like if, you know, back in, you know, however many years ago, you would write music, you'd go into a studio and the majority of it would be all live instruments. Now everything's done in the box, but now you're relying on the sample libraries. And if you get a great sample library, but don't know how to use it, it's going to sound like a sample library. And so, you know, for me, the two instruments that bug me the most are strings and a snare. And mostly strings. And if the strings sound fake, then I don't want it. I don't want fake strings. And that's not the goal. The goal is to have an elevated type of song that sounds like it's coming from a record label, but it's going to be an independent artist. And that's the level of music that we're trying to hit. So great mixed vocals. And I don't necessarily think it's vocals that are tracked well. I think it's vocals that are processed well, right? Because there's a talent in getting really great vocal sounds. It could be your the signal chain you're using. It could be the production. It could be how you're editing them. You know, so there's so many different things that come into play when hearing a song. I still go back to if I hear a song and it moves me emotionally, then it's good, right? And it could be any genre. Like there's times where I hear stuff, I'm like, I hate this genre, but the song is good, right? There's a place for this. And somebody who's requesting this style of music would be happy with this song. And so I have to take my personal, you know, preference out and say, yep, that's still going to be a really great song that somebody would want to license. And I think that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. I have a follower who, poor musician, didn't have a computer and did this amazing work all on his iPhone. I mean, amazing. Now, it sounded thin, didn't sound like it was done in a studio, but it was so well produced and so well made that he wound up getting some syncs out of it. Now, I'm sure what they did is they mastered it and they tarted it up afterwards. But the fact of the matter is, it can be done. And you know, there's an example. But I think that that's certainly the exception rather than the rule.
Well, and it's also knowing your tool. I mean, you can have a simple 57 mic and make some amazing songs with it because you know how to utilize it, right? And so, but you can also have a, you know, $87,000 microphone and it can still sound like crap. Right. Like it's again, it's like how you utilize the tools. I mean, guys are making amazing records in a Airbnb on their laptop. Right. Like that's the new studio. Like, let me go take my laptop, some sort of controller, a set of speakers. I'm going to go to town for a week.
I had Justin Bieber's engineer on one of the podcasts, one of the earlier ones. And he was telling me how much work they do in a hotel room. And he said sometimes they'll do a vocal and they'll have to have a mix the next day and they'll have to do it overnight on headphones in the hotel room. And that's what we end up hearing.
Yeah. And it's knowing how to, again, knowing how to use those tools, knowing what it sounds like on your headphones. So that way, when someone plays on a set of speakers, you know what it's going to sound like, you know how it's going to translate. Like that all comes from experience.
I'm just curious. You don't have to be specific or name any names, but what's the worst project you've ever worked on? Just a situation.
I don't really have any that come to mind right now, but every project has a learning place, even though it could be awful for me. Like, okay, why am I here? What can I get out of it? Right? Like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't like the people, but what lesson can I pull away from this? And I remember more of the hard projects that I've worked on, like, you know, the overnights, the long hours, like me, you know, waking up on the side of a road somewhere because I was so exhausted. You know, it was usually in Burbank somewhere going, where am I? Like I had the wherewithal to pull over because I'd been doing a 72-hour shift. Like those are hard. And in the moment, they're absolutely awful. But when I get to look back on them, I'm like, man, I learned so much from that experience. Or I didn't really get along well with this person, but I learned how to deal with that person for the next time I have to deal with somebody like that. And so I don't remember a lot of the really awful experiences, but I remember a lot of the hard experiences and the ones that are fun.
All right, last question. What's the best piece of business advice? The best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or you learned along the way in this journey that you've been on?
You know, there's this perception that this is the music business. And so some rules don't apply because it's a business. And people say it's based on relationships. And I agree. I think it's all based on relationships. But the way I like to look at it is not what my relationship I can get out of you, but what I can give to you, right? And so if I can build relationships on being able to help other people grow and help other people elevate, then we're all going to win. And being honest with one another, having integrity in everything we do, I think that's kind of the most important part of it.
You can find out more about Josh and Atrium Music at atriummusic.com. That's atriummusic, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.